This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Depending what the outcome is of the application hearing and the decision made by the Constitutional Court, it does open up a legal loophole for the entire legal system in the country.
That's South African political analyst Sanusha Naidu on President Jacob Zuma challenging a constitutional ruling in court. Details are coming up. Also today, 140 students in a boarding school in Nigeria's Kaduna state have been abducted. And protesters have taken to the streets demanding a democratically elected government in Eswatini. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Project Hope says health systems across Africa are extremely vulnerable and at risk of becoming quickly overwhelmed. That's already the case in countries like South Africa, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Namibia, and Uganda, where shortages of oxygen and ICU beds have been reported. Steve Nere, the regional director of Africa's at Project Hope, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi what the international community and the U.S. can do to help and how African governments should tackle the third wave of COVID-19.
There are a few things we need to consider here. There's the immediate need, which requires immediate action, and the longer-term solutions to address the global health inequities that COVID is shining a spotlight on right now. Immediately, ministries of health in African nations have a plan. They all have a COVID response task force, and they can tell you where the gaps are. So the donor community really needs to step in to support nations with their plans. Where non-governmental organizations like Project Hope can come in is that with resources, with funding, we can quickly support ministries to address their gaps because we're often able to respond more nimbly than governments and can do so in terms of executing their own plans. In order to speed vaccine rollout, Project Hope recommends countries take a threefold approach, building coordination and leadership capacity at national and subnational level, training healthcare workers and vaccinators, and rolling out a risk communication and community engagement strategy to improve awareness on vaccine safety and address hesitancy. In this regard, in partnership with Africa CDC, Brown University, and New York City Health and Hospitals, Project Hope has developed and rolled out a number of critical training packages across the continent of Africa. We have a COVID-19 response and preparedness, vaccine science and literacy, and mental health and resiliency to prevent burnout of the global health workforce, to educate them as community leaders so that they can address vaccine hesitancy and be prepared so that when the vaccines are available, they will not go to waste. With regard to the longer-term solutions to global public health inequity, the vaccine gap between developed and developing countries can no longer be ignored. Africa has the human capital, the ability to innovate, develop, and manufacture vaccines. Building vaccine development and manufacture capacity in Africa is critical as a part of the long-term solution. That's why we really welcome the recent announcements of Africa CDC to lay the groundwork to enable regional manufacturing of vaccines, as well as the announcement of the first COVID-19 mRNA vaccine technology transfer hub in South Africa. These are two big steps in the right direction.
So how differently should the African governments tackle this third wave of COVID-19 spike?
Without vaccines being available, the traditional public health measures really do need to be strengthened and adhered to. And so for the most part, African states have been pushing for successfully the population to wear masks. And we see that that's being done. Limits on public gatherings are really important because this virus is so much more transmissible. So we have to really push for the prevention interventions that we know work, while at the same time be prepared for the vaccine so when they do arrive, they can be administered as quickly as possible.
That was Steve Nere, the regional director of Africa at Project Hope, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. 140 students were snatched today from a boarding school in northwestern Nigeria. Emmanuel Paul, a teacher at Bethel Baptist High School in Kaduna State, told the French news agency AFP that 25 managed to escape, but the rest were still missing. Kaduna police spokesman Mohamed Jalgi confirmed the incident, but could not give details on the number of pupils taken. Yesterday, according to AFP, 8 medical employees who worked at Kaduna State's Saye Tuberculosis and Leprosy Health Center were kidnapped after a heavy exchange of fire with officers. Criminal groups have been terrorizing parts of northwest and central Nigeria. Most are motivated by material gain, although some have sworn allegiance to jihadist organizations. Eswatini's banned main opposition party has urged citizens protesting against the country's monarchy system to stay home following a deadly military crackdown. Protesters have taken to the streets demanding a democratically elected government. The Southern Africa Development Community has sent a fact-finding mission to Eswatini, but it is already being accused of taking sides. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
After more than a week of protests, many Eswatini shops have closed and streets are deserted. Protesters say the crackdown by security forces has left many of them in misery. Maxwell Dlamini is one of the activists fighting for a democratically elected government.
Most people are trying to go to South Africa to get, you know, essentials like food, fuel, and other supplies that they may need, you know, under this situation. So the closure of shops have quite hit the people very hard. But most importantly, the army that is still in the street, that is killing and shooting people indiscriminately, and the Southern is on the verge of a humanitarian crisis.
Mlungisi Makanya, president of the banned People's United Democratic Movement, says they've urged people to continue the protests by staying home after realizing that dozens have been shot, injured, killed, and arrested by security forces.
We have been receiving calls endlessly from very distraught and worried family members who are saying their kids and their relatives have been missing for the past 48 hours. But also I've seen dead bodies of people who have been shot. They were shooting people there and just dumping them in the nearest mortuary.
Mxolisi Ngamphalala is the spokesperson of the Communist Party of Swaziland.
The temporal absence of protests have been forced by the imposition of the military, who have killed many people. And that does not necessarily mean they have backed down. So up until liberation is achieved, there will be this kind of protest.
For years, civil society organizations and opposition parties have accused King Mswati of stifling democracy. They have also accused him of enriching himself with state resources and funds while most citizens live in poverty. His monarchy government is often accused of corruption, ill governance, and crackdowns on those who dare speak out. Efforts to get government reaction on the protests and crackdown allegations were not immediately successful. Last week, the government issued a statement saying it was investigating allegations that the army was shooting and killing civilians. The Southern African Development Community, SADC, has sent a fact-finding mission to Eswatini, but civil society organizations and opposition parties have accused it of bias after reportedly meeting only with the monarchy government officials and pro-government groups. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma, did not begin serving a prison sentence yesterday as he's been ordered to by the country's highest legislative body. The Constitutional Court sentenced him last week to 15 months in jail for refusing to testify at a commission of inquiry into corruption. Billions of dollars were stolen from state-owned enterprises while Zuma led South Africa between 2009 and 2018. But on Friday, 79-year-old Zuma appealed to the court to rescind its order. On Saturday, the judges said they will hear his appeal next Monday. Darren Taylor reports that, at least until then, he is a free man.
Zuma says the Constitutional Court must not send him to jail because he didn't mean to defy the inquiry and because prison would be a death sentence as he's suffering from an unspecified illness. Advocate Paul Hoffman says Zuma's main point is that the court didn't hear his side of the story.
It turns out from his own papers that he was not heard because he chose not to be heard and because he followed bad advice. Now, why that should be a basis for regarding the orders of court as erroneous escapes me, and I think he's going...
Political analyst Sanusha Naidu says the judges bowing to Zuma sets a dangerous precedent.
It's really intriguing, if not completely bizarre, I think, that the Constitutional Court is being asked to review its own order. It's being asked to review its own judgment. Depending what the outcome is of the application hearing and the decision made by the Constitutional Court, it does open up a legal loophole for the entire legal system in the country.
Many South Africans are outraged. They say if Zuma was to be treated as they would have been, the court would have dismissed his appeal immediately, and he'd be in a cell right now. Instead, he appeared on stage yesterday to address hundreds of supporters outside his home at Nkandla in KwaZulu-Natal province. Broadcast live on state TV, the former president wore a shiny black suit emblazoned with the green and gold insignia of the ruling African National Congress. Zuma saluted the resilience of his allies and said, "Arresting and jailing me will raise from the dead the comrades I fought with against apartheid." An excited and smiling Zuma showed no signs of any sickness. Rather, he danced and sang the apartheid struggle song that's become his signature tune of defiance in the face of the political persecution he claims he's suffering at the hands of President Cyril Ramaphosa. "Bring me my machine gun," Zuma warbled as his supporters joined in. One of his former Liberation Army cadres, Carl Niaus, said veterans would form a human shield around Zuma should the police try to arrest their patron.
"We will not allow President Zuma to go to jail. But whatever we will do within the parameters and the confines of the law."
But many Zuma backers broke the law as the police looked on. Crowds of Zulu men calling themselves Zuma's impi or warriors brandished spears and wooden clubs. Some fired guns into the sky. Others assaulted journalists. None were arrested. Hoffman says Zuma's antics this weekend should mean his latest appeal has zero chance of succeeding.
"I think that Mr. Zuma is really shooting himself in the foot. He's now conducting himself in a way that shows he has no respect for the rule of law, no respect for the COVID regulations, no regard for the safety of his own supporters, his irresponsibility as a leader. He cannot expect to win in court if he turns a court process into a political stunt."
But South Africans know that time and again, Zuma's been given no chance to evade arrests and courts and inquiries and prison cells. Time and again, he's escaped. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Ugandans may find themselves in jail for 2 months if they are found breaking public health controls in a new COVID-19 law. Through July, acts such as praying in open spaces, not wearing masks, hawking, street vending, and selling non-food items will get one arrested. These are now deemed acts that enable the spread of COVID-19. Uganda has registered 1,057 new cases, 1,081 active cases, and 1,061 deaths. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Samples collected in early June indicate that the predominant COVID strain currently in Uganda is the Delta variant first seen in India. Jane Ruth Acheng is the Minister for Health.
From our observations, we have noted increased transmissibility resulting in a fast-moving outbreak, more severe clinical presentations of new cases, and unfortunately resulting in poor clinical outcomes.
Acheng says Uganda will most likely reach the peak of daily case numbers in late July or early August before registering a slight drop in cases. That is why, through July, anyone found praying in an open space or outside a church or a mosque, not wearing masks, hawking, street vending and selling non-food items will be sentenced to 2 months in jail. Anyone found operating a bar or a movie theater, attending a seminar, cultural event or indoor sports event could face jail time if convicted. State Minister for Health Anifa Kawoya says the law is necessary.
These penalties are not punishments. In one way is to instill attitude change. That's the moment that you know that if I don't observe these SOPs, this will happen.
The new law also prohibits entry of visitors from India other than Ugandan citizens or residents. Anyone who aids in the escape of someone confined in a place designated for isolation or quarantine of COVID-19 can also be imprisoned for 2 months. The health ministry hopes that once the government can acquire more vaccines, fewer people will be severely affected and in need of critical care in hospitals. So far, 861,645 people have been inoculated with their first dose of AstraZeneca and 129,257 have had their second dose. Between July and August, Uganda expects to receive 974,400 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine from the COVAX facility and another 300,000 Sinovac doses from China. To encourage Ugandans to get vaccinated, the country is currently undertaking a study to monitor vaccine efficacy by counting COVID infections that may occur in vaccinated people.
Preliminary investigations showed that no hospitalized persons we are fully vaccinated at the time of illness. Therefore, there is no current evidence to support the allegations that fully vaccinated persons have acquired severe infection and died in Uganda.
Uganda has also applied for 2 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine through the African Export-Import Bank and the African Union, and another 9 million doses through the COVAX cost-sharing facility. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
The UN Children's Fund is urging the international community to pay more attention to Niger, where more than 2 million people are malnourished and living in dire conditions. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than 3.8 million people in Niger, more than half children, are facing a humanitarian crisis because of a combination of natural and man-made disasters. Niger, a landlocked country, is facing attacks by Islamist militants and other armed groups along its borders with Nigeria in the south, Burkina Faso, in the southeast, Mali, in the west, and in the Lake Chad region in the east. This has led to significant displacements in the country and is creating havoc for hundreds of thousands of children. Besides conflict, the UN Children's Fund reports Niger is dealing with food shortages, malnutrition, recurrent disease epidemics, climate-related disasters such as floods and drought, and the socioeconomic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. The UNICEF representative in the Niger country office, Abu Bakri Tal, says malnutrition remains a major threat to children's health and development. Speaking on a video link from the capital, Niamey, he says the rate of acute severe malnutrition remains extremely high. He says 2.2 million people need nutrition assistance, of whom 1.6 million are children under age five.
Also about 500,000, 450,000 exactly, who are suffering from severe acute malnutrition and therefore become almost condemned to a life of underachievement if they survive.
UNICEF reports more than 370 schools have been forced to close over recent months due to insecurity and conflict-affected areas. It says attacks on schools and threats to education are destroying the hopes and dreams of an entire generation of children. Representative Tal says UNICEF is working across the country to help those affected by emergencies and conflicts. He notes displaced people mostly live in host communities and share everything with them, shelter, land, food, whatever they have. He says displaced people do not rely totally on humanitarian assistance to survive.
People grow food, people do small businesses on the side, buying and selling goods, for example. There's a lot of economic activity, which some of the humanitarian programs do also support through cash transfers, through support to food production.
Tal says UNICEF is working with the government and humanitarian partners to respond to acute emergencies, such as population movements, and to mitigate risks. He says the agency needs more than $100 million to deliver vital humanitarian aid to children throughout the country this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thousands of demonstrators flooded the streets of Burkina Faso's capital on Saturday to call for a tougher government response to a wave of jihadist attacks that have destabilized the West African country in recent years. Some protesters traveled hundreds of kilometers to attend the opposition-led demonstration in Ouagadougou, where protesters waved the red and green Burkinabe flag and blew whistles. Groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State, originally based in neighboring Mali, have embedded themselves across the north and east of the country, launching regular attacks on civilians, including one in June that killed more than 130 people. Pressure has increased on President Roch Kabore to take control and end a humanitarian crisis in which more than a million people have been displaced by the violence. Last Wednesday, Kabore took the role of defense minister in a cabinet reshuffle aimed at appeasing opposition leaders who have demanded the resignation of the government. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the